It is Saturday, July 15th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today we are focusing on the Microsoft and the creation of their new Xbox. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on our program are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our show, we are talking with Dean Takahashi about his new book, Xbox 360 Unclocked. He knows a lot about Microsoft's inner workings, especially around gaming consoles, and it should be a wonderful discussion. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics. Offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services, Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Welcome to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Today we're going to be talking about the Xbox 360, the new book called Xbox 360 Unclocked by Dean Takahashi. But we'll be first doing some geek news. So, gentlemen, I'd like to start with you, Sean, since I know you've got something. What's going on with Intel?
So Intel released their new processor this past week. At least to the press. So reviewers, the embargo for producing reviews based on the Core 2 Duo and Core 2 Extreme processors.
They released that embargo?
Released that embargo, but don't expect any availability until the end of the month when they do their big announcement.
Do you think they'll be doing mass production at that point and be able to buy it right away? Are they going to launch this hard?
Actually, word is that there aren't going to be a lot of units available until after the month of August. So you can expect big manufacturers like Dell and HP to probably get the lion's share of the pick.
Okay.
So if you're looking to buy a system and you want the latest and greatest, it's definitely the fastest. It smacks down every other processor that's out there.
You're talking about timeline. You're talking about a timeline in September. So basically,
you know, it'll be available in August. Okay. Just don't expect to go to your, you know, local Fry's and see it on the shelf.
Right.
I mean, maybe you'll get lucky.
So is there anything new with this release that they made? Is it just more people are seeing it? Are you seeing reviews from?
Oh yeah. So reviews hit on Thursday. Well, Friday really. From various sites, all the big ones, and they did comparisons versus AMD's Athlon XP. Athlon 64, let me get that straight. They did it versus Athlon 64 X2 and FX processors. FX is their enthusiast line.
Okay.
And they also did comparisons versus the Pentium D, which is the Pentium 4 architecture. The Core 2 is just a very powerful chip. So in system benchmarks, and we're talking about, you know, MPEG compression,
all the stuff, you know, that all takes processing time.
Your office apps, that sort of thing. Big performance increase, especially over the Pentium 4. I mean, in one day, they've made the Pentium 4 line obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Really. And those prices now are like $100 for their top-end chip.
If you've got a Pentium 4 machine, could you put one of these new chips in it and get a lot of performance?
No. It's the same socket 775. So it would fit. You would think that it would work. But the Core 2 requires new voltage regulators. Mm-hmm. It's different type of power, more power actually, and current motherboards won't support.
So right now, if someone called you and said, you know, I'm editing video and I want to buy a new computer, you'd say, wait and get this processor.
Yeah.
And you've even told me, don't buy a Macintosh right now because Apple's probably going to start using this.
Yeah, they'll start using this Core 2, and you're going to see a big performance increase. That said, if you're a gamer and you want to do an upgrade, and you've got a Pentium 4 processor, or an Athlon 64. But I can't really say that I would recommend an upgrade to Core 2.
Why?
Because you're going to get more bang for your buck by upgrading your GPU, your graphics. Because at high resolutions, and that's what you wanted to play with games, and we're talking in just 1280 by 1024 or above, if you really want to get faster frame rates and you want to see more in the game, take advantage of, you know, better lighting, better effects, you know, all the cool things that come with games, you're better off buying, upgrading your graphics than your CPU.
Okay. Thank you very much for that story about Intel's new Core Duo. Miles, hi.
Hi. So, the University of Alberta, through some research, has created the sharpest object ever.
Good.
Basically, you have an object that is tipped with a single atom. That's how sharp it is.
Isn't every item eventually, I mean, isn't everything eventually a mono atom?
Well, no, you'll have things that are layered.
Round.
Like, think, for example, if you have a butter knife. The reason why it's not as sharp as a steak knife is because that point, or that edge, doesn't go to as small a point.
It goes to a very round thing.
Right. Right.
So you're talking about
flat.
You're talking about
cases.
A needle, basically, or something like that, that goes up to one atom.
Well, no, it's, well, yeah.
What's the atom?
Or rather, at its peak, it's one atom. Okay. So along an edge.
Oh, an edge. So it's a whole blade. So what is the what's the material?
At the very tip?
Yeah.
It's a nitrogen atom.
Okay. Okay. What is this going to be for?
Oh, I'm
how
sorry.
They
I'm
build
sorry.
It?
I take that back. It was
it's a sharp pointy thing.
Able to
that you can't hold.
Miles is like pointy.
Well, at the same time, if the sharper something is, the easier it is to cut. I know that sounds, you know, obvious, but it's the amount of it's the amount of pressure you have to put on there. For example, a butter knife, you would have to put a lot of force to cut a steak. It could still cut a steak. It would just require more force. Whereas if you have a very sharp steak knife, you can go into it and it'll cut immediately. So what this will do is you can basically go up and touch something and it'll split.
Kind of like what
so bacteria, viri, stuff like that.
Scalpels are kind of like this. So is this a microscopic thing? No, this isn't going to be implemented. You're not going to see this on your steak knives.
Right.
Okay, good.
Well,
because I'd be scared.
Right, yeah.
So is this,
like
for, is this for doing more work at the nano level?
Right. Like so little pores that that form in our cell walls, which, you know.
Yeah, you poke into and put new material into the cell. Things like
exactly.
That. All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
If you use Adobe Acrobat to read PDF files, or you have it installed, you should probably go to Adobe website and get their new patch. It fixes a bunch of security flaws, two major ones. And it even gives some other Adobe-type fixes in there. So if you're running 6.04 or earlier, you really need to get this patch. In fact, you might want to upgrade to 6.05.
This is just Acrobat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Acrobat Reader.
All right.
Because there are some malicious PDFs out there that can damage your computer, believe it or not. So go get those updates.
All right. Thank you. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxel. With me in the air rooms, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. We just did some geek news. And now we're going to go back kind of in time to a show that we did in 2002. That's about 4 years ago. We had Dean Takahashi on. And he, at that point, had written his first book about the Xbox. Unlocking the Xbox?
Yes.
Okay. And now, opening the Xbox, that's what it's
opening
called.
Opening the Xbox.
And now, you've got a new book, Dean. Welcome, Dean, first to Geek Speak.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here with us. Your new book takes that same story of the creation of the Xbox, and you basically did the same journalism, talking to all the new people that are involved in it with the new Xbox, Xbox 360. And one of the things that you do about both your books are very much about the stories behind the Xbox.
What's the second book called, though?
Oh, I'm so sorry. The new book, and I've lost my notes in front of me. That's probably why I didn't do it. The new book is called Xbox 360 Unlocked. It's an in-depth study.
Uncloaked.
I'm sorry, Unclocked.
And Uncloaked.
Uncloaked.
Yeah.
How embarrassing. We're going to edit the podcast so this never goes on the web. Only to all of California. Okay, so... Dean, let me ask you first off, Your first book kind of paints a picture of Microsoft posed to take over game consoles. In fact, the tagline was "Inside Microsoft's plan to unleash an entertainment revolution." How's Microsoft done? Has it been pretty successful in doing that?
Well, they got about 20% of the market, and that was pretty good for their first time around. And they unfortunately lost about $3.7 billion getting that 20% of the market. So financially, it wasn't a great bargain for them to go into the video game business. But they saw it as an investment for the future.
Now,
it would pay off in maybe the second or third version.
Wow. So, but I mean, 20% of the game market, that sounds like a lot of money. Why haven't they made a lot of money off of just being a 20% player?
Well, they started out late, and they put a box together as fast as they could, and they used off-the-shelf PC parts. And those parts had already been cost-reduced as much as possible in the PC market. And so normally when you're preparing ahead of time, you're designing your own chips for a console. And Microsoft didn't really have the chance to do that. So it had to take what it could get. It took a hard drive that cost about $50 and put it in every machine. And, that really didn't, differentiate the box all that much from PlayStation 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it sunk the cost even more. So the wound up costing like $425, and they had to sell it for $300. So every box they sold went out with a big loss.
So their business, obviously, they're trying to make money on this. Their plan just is the long haul, to saturate the market with their stuff, get a lot of games out there, and then in the second or third rev, to make tons of money on it.
Right.
One of the things in researching the show last night, right after the show that we did 4 years ago, and the book hit the shelves, Seamus Black, the co-creator and lead evangelist for Microsoft's Xbox, quit. He resigned from Microsoft.
Oh, when was this?
This was right after. This was in April of 2002.
Yes, that's right.
So Dean, there was some speculation that the amount of information that was given to you about your first book and Inside and such had some cause and some correlation to Blackley leaving. Is that true?
I think he was already on his way out well before the book hit, and in some ways, the book may have helped him get out the door, but really, he was kind of one of these people who was more like a square peg in a round hole at Microsoft. He wanted to make games. He wanted to be heavily involved in the creation of games.
Yeah, and all the big innovators at Microsoft were kind of that way, though. Alex St. John, he didn't fit in.
Yeah.
And he founded DirectX, which is the core basis.
He just got it started, and he let it go. Really.
Now, Blackley, I mean, in your first book, he's kind of your hero to some degree in pushing this product through and making and having the dream. And I mean, you definitely, I think, paint a pretty good picture about the passion of the system and the people behind it, and the frustration of being at Microsoft. Your new book has a lot of similarities in that same story, in that there's, I mean, there's a lot more money behind the product, but is it still, how has it changed? How has the team changed when you talked to them 4 years ago versus now on making this next version?
Well, I still think it's an epic undertaking, and that's why I wanted to write this second book. And I saw some of the same stories in there. There was the same kind of clash between the gamers and the corporate people inside Microsoft, and they really had to sort of come to terms together in order to get something that was both a good business proposition and cool as well, something that gamers would like. And so people like Ed Fries, who ran the games division, he came into very direct clashes with people on the business side about how they were going to make a good business going forward, and what was the best way to exploit a property like Halo, for instance.
The premier game on the Xbox when it came out.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the new book and the new Xbox, the Xbox 360. Do you think that it's improved dramatically from the Xbox? Do they do some things differently that you really are happy with?
Well, I think technically they were smarter about planning it this time. A lot of the book is actually about the creation of the chips, and a lot of that work happened here in Silicon Valley. And they had a lot more time to create a custom solution this time. So they had a multi-core microprocessor from IBM that was really kind of ahead of its time compared to what was on Intel's roadmap. And so the Microsoft engineers sort of foresaw this coming collision between power consumption and megahertz and whether you could get a lot of work done with just one thread. And so because they foresaw that, they were able to get something different out of IBM. And so that, I think, is making a big difference in how much bang for the buck they could get out of the processor. I think I'm not so sure they made the right decision on whether to include a hard drive in every box or not. Sony has gone ahead and included a hard drive in every box with the PlayStation 3 that's coming out in November. And I think if you don't put a hard drive in every box, then the developers who are making the online games or other games can't assume it's there, and so they will shoot for the lowest common denominator in their games, and you know they won't be as ambitious in exploiting.
Well, how did that decision get made to release kind of two different versions of the Xbox 360, one with a hard drive, one without? How did they decide to do that?
They from the very beginning knew that they had a huge problem with the hard drive costs on the first box, and they were looking for some kind of way out of that cost problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so fairly early on, the engineers said, "Well, you know, if you're going to save a game, you can save to some kind of storage device, but we're not going to tell you what it is." And so they virtualized the storage in that sense, and they made this choice available for the executives, and that you could either store a game on flash memory, or you could store it on a hard drive. And so once they kind of made that decision available to the execs decided to exploit it and said, well, last time around we lost a bundle putting a hard drive in every box, so this time around we've got to help out our business model as much as possible.
It's interesting because that decision has done two things. One is it's made the developers not make games that really rely on the hard drive as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also made therefore, when you decide, well, I think the Xbox should have a hard drive in it, I'm going to spend more on my version, you're actually not getting as much out of the games because mm-hmm. the developers didn't make them that way. So mm-hmm. do you think that buying the lower common denominator box makes sense, or do you still recommend like having that hard drive in there?
I am not sure exactly what games are exploiting the hard drive. I mean, I assume the online heavy games. If you're really into that, then you're going to want the hard drive there.
What
so you can download new levels or download.
Sure.
Whatever it is you need.
What else? We're talking with Dean Takahashi, author of The Xbox 360 Uncloaked, The Real Story Behind Microsoft's Next Generation Video Game Console. Also in the air with Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. My name's Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. Dean, what else does PlayStation 3 have coming down the pipe that's going to be better or more competitive to the Xbox 360?
Oh, it's got a Blu-ray drive in it, and that's a high-definition mass storage on disk. And that is sort of the big question mark. Is that the right decision? It's costing Sony a lot of money to put that drive on every PlayStation 3. And the estimates for the cost of the PlayStation 3, are around $800 or $900. And they're selling them for either $500 or $600.
Wow.
And so they're taking a much bigger loss on every box, potentially, than Microsoft did. And Sony doesn't have as much money to burn as Microsoft.
But the 360, the Xbox 360 doesn't have a high definition or Blu-ray drive in it.
That's right. It's got a regular DVD drive.
And
Microsoft's going to start selling a HD DVD accessory in the fall, but it's not going to be something that is going to be incorporated into games. And so it's really there just if you want to watch HD movies.
One of the things about a console game system compared to like running your PC is that the specs are like really there. It's very clear. If you buy a game for the Xbox 360, it works on your Xbox 360. And you just mentioned one thing that's different between different versions. Do you think Sony's going to make this kind of decision between having Blu-ray in it or not? There was some talk early on that they might have versions that don't have a normal DVD player in them. What do you think?
No, I think they're kind of committed to Blu-ray. Sony thinks differently in some sense. Like Microsoft looks at each generation as a 5-year generation, but Sony is looking at this as like a something that's going to be in the market for 10 years. That's been the case with their consoles because they're so successful. So the PlayStation 1, 12 years or so, and PlayStation 2 is on its way. And if you have a product in the market for that long, then you don't want to have what they would consider to be an obsolete technology on it. So I don't think they're going to drop Blu-ray.
Dean, in doing this book, you basically are a pretty technically savvy, very technically savvy a journalist, and you're interviewing, hundreds of people, I would assume, on the chip manufacturing, the design, the people in making the systems. To some degree, I'm sure that you've talked to game developers as well.
Yeah, you're an outsider looking in.
Yeah, but you definitely have this inside perspective on Microsoft, which is very notable. So what do you think of Microsoft? Would you want to work there?
Would I want to work there?
Yeah. I mean, I know that you're a journalist. You have a free reign. Your column in the San Jose Mercury News is wonderful in that it's you and you're not being told in a lot of ways what to do. So,
It would seem like it would be fun to be there and to get into arguments with people in a big room and say, all right, this is way we get the way we got to do the console. I mean, that might be fun. in a lot of other ways, I think, I see a lot of the game people don't necessarily last as long at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. They do have a lot of veterans there, but they've also had a lot of churn, and I think it can be a hard place to work in that respect because you make your big argument, your passionate pitch to do something the right way, and
then millions of dollars flow that way too. I mean, it's a very powerful. What is it from the structure perspective? I mean. Is there a very strange structure? I mean, does Ballmer kind of, throw people in different directions?
There's tension there because, Gates is the technology fan and Ballmer's the financial guy. And then there's also tension in that the company's business is not primarily games. It's software and other things. And the Xbox is often viewed as something that has to fit in with the rest of the product line. So it has to be Windows friendly, or it has to be Windows Media Center friendly, but it can't do the exact same things that those programs do, or those devices do. So they're almost always asked to make some kind of compromise in order to fit in with the larger strategy of the company, and I think that's not an easy thing for the gamer side.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the room with me, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. We're speaking with Dean Takahashi, the author of the Xbox 360 Uncloaked, the real story behind Microsoft's next-generation video game console. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com.
KOSP co-sponsors the Moving In Storage Crash Burn and Die Company's presentation of Lily, Book 1. This performance is by the Flaming Puppet Sisters and is inspired by several Chinese folk tales with a modern twist. The story is about two sisters who want to save their youngest sister, Lily, who has picked a flower growing near the enchanted red stream. The sisters are portrayed by both puppets and masked dancers. Book 1 will be performed July 15th and 16th at the 418 Project in Santa Cruz. For tickets and more information, please call 466-9770.
The Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute is having an open house today in Moss Landing from noon to 5. You can learn more at our website, geekspeak.org. Just click on today's show page, July 15th, 2006. And speaking of July 15th, 2006, 6 years ago today, Daria Malden chose to marry me. Daria, happy anniversary. 6 years, two kids, and we still seem to enjoy each other. I love you very much.
GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering DSL, broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruise.io has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland. We also have Miles Elam here. And, of course, our guest, Dean Takahashi, author and expert of the Xbox 360, Uncloaked. Dean's also staff writer at the San Jose Mercury News on technology, and he is, you know, in the hub of Silicon Valley. Therefore, he knows a lot about what's going on here in technology, and the two geeks here know a bit, and I can cover some. So if you'd like to call us up, ask us questions, please feel free. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us questions at geekspeak.org. Again, the phone numbers to call us with questions and comments about technology, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Dean, I know that you've got to leave us in about 15 minutes, so let's get some stuff out of you that I really want to know, not necessarily about your book, but
okay.
In the Mercury News, how do you decide or who decides what goes in your column?
It's usually a group of editors get together in the morning and they see what is good and what all the staff reporters are producing that day. And then they edit stories and get them together by the afternoon around 3:30 or so, and they decide again what's going to make it and how long each story's going to be. And so it's a collaborative process there.
And your book, how is it like to write? I mean, obviously you did another one, so you do enjoy it. What's different about it?
This one was just so many more people involved. You know, I could talk to maybe 20 people on the last one and get maybe 90% of the story. But if you talk to 20 people on this one, it's like 20 people out of a couple of thousand.
It's a drop in the bucket, huh?
It's just harder. Yeah. So this one is more like a representative sample of what happened. You know, it's harder to capture every single piece of the reality that happened. But, you know, it was different characters as well, different people. And the thing I liked this time is that there were people that you could sort of zoom in on who stood for things that were just sort of larger than their own story. And so, you know, one guy standing up for what he believes in and, you know, not budging on what he wanted to do and then quitting the company as a result. You know, things like that.
So his vision was ultimately, you know, is that what became Xbox 360? Or were there a lot of compromises?
I think, you know, the whole 360 decision-making and planning this time was just much more elaborate, and so you can't really... You could say that Jay Allard was, you know, the primary guy behind making it all happen, but it was really a much more collective work this time. I mean, they had separate people broken out for the industrial design, a lot of people here down in Silicon Valley making the calls on the chips, people at ATI and IBM, so it was all spread out and... You know, some people worried that it was designed by committee. You know, if you look at the end result, it all does come together pretty well.
So, yeah, I work at NVIDIA. So what happened there? Why ATI?
We're talking about the graphics card in the box.
Yeah, the graphics card in the 360.
Yeah, NVIDIA had a lot of bad blood on the first one because they had disputes over pricing. They had different expectations over schedules. You know, when there was a security flaw that was exploited, Microsoft wanted to turn to NVIDIA to patch it up. but NVIDIA then needed a lot more money in order to do that. And you know, so things like that just made for a bad partnership. And ATI came along and had sort of some of the same qualms about working with Microsoft, but they decided to accommodate Microsoft's business model requests more so than NVIDIA would. So ATI said it's okay if you get the rights to this chip and you can have it made in any factory that you mm-hmm. want to Microsoft. And that was a key part of whether Microsoft could make this the graphics chip affordable or not, and they could bring it down in cost reduce it on their own schedule.
Right.
That was important to Microsoft.
Now, the original Xbox was supposed to use an AMD processor.
And at the time, Sean, you worked at AMD, I believe.
No, I was still an editor.
Okay.
But I happened to be at the Game Developers Conference where AMD expected the big announcement to happen, and they were just as shocked as everyone else.
Microsoft
when pulled the rug
Microsoft decided to use Intel. Yeah.
Yeah, Paul Ottolina at Intel pulled out a last-minute deal just like on the night before.
Did that deal include them losing money as well on the product?
Intel did okay, but it didn't do so well that they thought that it would be a great idea for the next time around to dedicate a whole engineering team to customizing a solution for Microsoft. And that's what Microsoft wanted, and Intel was saying, you know, well, you gotta step up with a lot more money if you want a much more custom solution.
So what did they end up doing then?
Intel wound up not really having the right solution for Microsoft in the first place, because they were almost nowhere on multi-core and multi-threading, and IBM had already been moving down that road pretty well.
All right, we're going to start taking some calls today on GeekSpeak online. If you'd like to be like David from Aptos, you're welcome to give us a call, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Hello, David. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Lyle, hi. On Thursday's Sentinel, there was a column by Walter Mossberg. He's like the little tech guy in the Sentinel, about a new free application called Pando, where it allows you to basically send up to 1 gig of attachments, which I would consider like photos.
Right.
But it doesn't like clog up, it doesn't lock up your email. One, do you know anything about it? And two, how is that possible?
Well, a lot of these services actually, they allow you to upload the file to a web server, and then they give a unique link to that file that you can then email.
Right.
So the person receives a link to a file and are able to download it. It's equivalent to doing it yourself. I'm not sure what their revenue source would be on this product. I'm not really familiar with it, and I didn't read the article in Sentinel. But it's not an uncommon product. There's lots of them out there. Miles, are you familiar with this guy?
I've never Pando. Heard of it.
Well, if you go on pando.com, you can find it. But I was just wondering if the person receiving the files, are they just for viewing, or they could use them for actually
anything.
Physically printing them? Or
yeah,
no, we need to go research this. Walt Mossberg is, I mean, he usually doesn't recommend technology unless you're really.
Really
likes it, yeah.
Right.
He's really hard on tech.
Right.
So yeah. I'd be really curious to see how this works.
Okay. Well, I just thought I saw it in Thursday's paper.
Yep.
I also
we'll take a look at it and talk about it next week.
I sent you the link.
Good.
Lyle@geekspeak.org. So if you you might want to check it out.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it next week. We're going to check it out.
That'd be great.
Yeah. These services. It's really about delivering larger file formats, and it makes sense. I mean, we shouldn't be sending large files, like 4 megabytes, as big as you should really email.
Wow. And you know what though? I have a Gmail account specifically for doing that kind
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah,
it's
people
amazing.
Do that a lot.
The only drawback, of course, is that we all have broadband that's 6 megabits or less.
Right. You still have to wait for it. Actually, speaking of like large file stuff, Dean, one of the things you did on this book you didn't do on the last, and it's becoming more and more common, is e-publishing, making a PDF available of the book. And
yeah.
I have a PDF of the book that actually has my name across it. I'm assuming when you sell them, you actually personalize the PDF to each person. Did you like doing this? Does it afford you some kind of?
Doing this by the way, the link is at spiderworks.com. And, it was the only way I could really tell this story because if you think of the market window for this book, it's after 360 launches and probably before the PlayStation 3 launches.
Right.
And, I had, I didn't get the first interviews with Microsoft on this really until after the launch. So between December and April was the time when I had to write it. You know, if I finished in April on a traditional book, it would come out 6 months later. But in this case, I finished in April, and with the ebook, we got it out on May 8th. So it was just, really fast turnaround. And there's nice features about the ebook too, like it's searchable. You can just click on anything, and you can link to something from the index, for example.
Yeah. Are you fearful of people? Yeah. Are you fearful of people sharing the book? Like you specifically said, don't share this, blah blah blah. But I actually did send it to Miles and to Sean so that they could both be privy to our conversation today. What do you think about that? Are you concerned?
It is a problem, and I think more people will if they really want it, they're still order the paperback. And then I think the big concern is if it shows up on a big file sharing site or something like that. And in that case, we have the name of the person, at least, who would have...
Who originally bought it.
...that copyright.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea that you're not trying to use some of these digital rights management software solutions to make the book available, because then it is always a concern when you pay for something like that. Is the technology going to be around for you to always read it and all that? Instead, you just basically say, this is registered to this person. And that seems to be a format that most publishers are doing with their ebooks. Let's get back into a couple questions. Well, actually, we have to say goodbye to you in just a moment, so let me give you the floor to some degree. What is it about the Xbox and the whole Microsoft development of this that drives your passion and interest in it?
Well, I said before, it's like an epic story, and there's real people, interesting people, some very smart people involved in it, and I like following what they do. But there's always these different kinds of struggles involved in getting something as big as a game console off the ground and into the market, and that includes the battles between the gamers and the corporate types within the company. Just arguments about how to do it right between the engineers and the marketers. The industrial designers get involved. The chip makers, this big jockeying for position going on among the component suppliers, the Intels, the NVIDIAs, ATIs. They're all at war with each other, and it's over who gets into the box. And then there's this global battle between Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft. And on top of that, there's always this battle for video games to be recognized as a legitimate art form.
Right.
That is as important as any other kind of entertainment. And so all those things put together are just, always fascinating to me.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. Our guest today has been Dean Takahashi. The Xbox 360 Uncloaked is his book, the real story behind Microsoft's next-generation video game console. Dean has to leave us now. Let me just plug you a little bit, Dean. Staff writer at San Jose Mercury News. He writes about video games, semiconductors, and other technology stories. He has been a journalist for over 18 years, most of that covering technology news. He previously worked at Red Herring Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, the San Jose Mercury News, Los Angeles Times Orange County Edition, the Orange County Register, and the Dallas Times Herald. He's an avid gamer, player, and lives in San Jose area with his wife and three kids. And now you're going to go take your kids swimming. Thank you very much for spending the Saturday morning with us. Dean.
Yeah, thank you. I forgot to put in there that I've been blogging a lot lately on games as well. On my blog called Dean and Nooch on Gaming with my partner Mike Antonucci at the Mercury News.
We will put that up on geekspeak.org. Thank you so much, Dean.
All right, thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Now's the time to call in with questions and comments of technology. We have we got three geeks here waiting to take your calls with questions and comments. Keep in mind, we don't have internet. Are we up with internet, guys?
Nope, we're back up.
Oh, thank you. It's so great to have geeks in the house. They just fix things as you don't even know it. So the phone number is to call us with questions or comments about anything you would like. 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm going to do that again, nice and slow. 476-2800. or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we can answer questions about anything you'd like.
Or go to the website. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Drop us an email.
All right. We while we wait for stories to wait for calls to come in or emails, let's go ahead and do some news. Miles, you got one more. I'm sure I cut you off earlier.
Great. Now you're going to make me look it up.
Got to backtrack. Like, we were done with news an hour
ago. Ah, here we go. Yeah. Story about Wikipedia.
That's that giant encyclopedia that anybody can edit.
Right. And upon the death of Enron's CEO, Ken Lay, or former CEO, the Wikipedia article on Ken Lay had information saying he died, but there was a lot of supposition saying at one point the stress due to the trial and the like caused the death, and then it was under curious circumstances, or they don't know what's going to happen.
As so the breaking news edits. Happened, a lot of edits happened.
Okay. Or just, yeah, multiple edits going in there. So they got slammed by Reuters. Reuters put out a hit piece on Wikipedia saying that it just wasn't reliable. Look at this. They had to retract all of this in this series of items. And it all happened very quickly, but they were showing this timeline. Well, as a funny circumstance, Reuters has had to retract their story on Ken Lay's death because of the fact they couldn't cite a source, you know, with certainty.
So you think somebody got upset that they used Wikipedia as their source, then they start writing
an article? No, they didn't use Wikipedia as their source. It was someone who was slamming Wikipedia because they couldn't get their facts straight, and they had to do a retraction.
Had to retract as well. I think that's pretty funny. What do you think about that issue of, I mean, that's definitely true. When you buy an encyclopedia, you know that, like a physical one, you know that there's been months since the information has changed and somebody really researched it, and you know it's all good. It's definitely true about the Wikipedia system.
Or in the case of most of us that don't buy encyclopedias every year.
Okay. So the thing with the Wikipedia is that people can edit it on the fly, and therefore it's changing all the time. So for breaking news, you've got a situation where you're not really sure the state that it's at. And I'm assuming there's definitely this idea that I want to be the one that changes it. So there's probably this kind of rolling
fund that
happens. Which
is the energy behind Wikipedia.
Which is
saying,
great.
Like, I can contribute to
that,
this
That
item.
Contribution inspiration is the reason why it works. Is there an interface on Wikipedia, do you know, that tells you when it was edited or how much it's been edited recently? Because all they'd have to do is raise some kind of alert about that.
Well, yeah, you can see the edit history to it, absolutely.
Yeah, I think if they just put some kind of icon in there saying that this is stable for 4 months or this isn't, and had some kind of representation about its change, then you'd feel better. Like, if I know I'm reading a Wikipedia entry that hasn't been modified for a week, I'm pretty sure that that content's okay, assuming that's not some esoteric thing that no one would know to check, because there's so many people checking.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are other issues with it, but then again, these are issues that occur in a lot of different encyclopedias. But with regard to technology or science or mathematics, Wikipedia is a great authoritative source. Once you get out of that arena, the other encyclopedias start to shine, especially with regard to history or politics, because Wikipedia, I mean, they've been changing. They've been improving their processes, but they're still mob rule.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's its strength and its drawback.
How much can we trust it, the data there?
How much can you trust anything you read on the internet?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Let's
you know, I was doing, I've been reading some historical books, and, you know, Madagascar during the reign of one particular queen was quite a nasty place in the mid-1800s. So I wanted to go read up on that, and I found an amazing amount of just really good information.
At Wikipedia?
At Wikipedia, yeah. Yeah.
Well, if it's not contentious at all, that it'll usually be pretty good.
Yeah.
If it's a contentious issue, that's when you have to really take a large...
When do they lock it down and stop people from changing stories?
When an article is being hit multiple times. Like, if there's a lot of people overwriting other ones.
Right.
Because they were finding, for example, that political pundits or wonks were going in and editing their favorite politician.
Sure.
Editing the entries on there to make them look more appealing or to make them look less appealing.
Yeah. It's just so weird to see at the bottom of the story, you know, you can go make changes to it,
right,
or you can create a new page.
One of my passions is on the phone, so not physically, but the topic. So let's go ahead and take Andrew from Watsonville. Welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question today, Andrew?
Hi. My question is that just that I'm looking for a Dungeons & Dragons DM who will play with my friend Saul and me.
Did you
maybe
say
some
pay?
Other friends of mine. I have quite a I have quite a number of people who'd love to play, but, you know, obviously it's up to the DM, like, whether anybody gets in at all.
All right. Well, so in Watsonville, what's the game store there?
There is, I don't know. I don't think there is one. I guess there's one in Santa Cruz called Game-A-Lot.
Sure, sure. There's definitely one in Game-A-Lot. It's a shame there's not one in Watsonville, because the trick is, of course, to hang out around the local game store.
And there's one also in Scotts Valley called Epic Adventure Games.
Oh, Far Out. Well, I'll remember that. Okay, I'll try and drop by.
Because they do games there in the store.
Yeah, I would go ahead and try to go online and try to find a chat group or something and start mentioning Watsonville to see if there's anybody in Watsonville that's doing that, because that's the real trick, is to find someone else that's looking for a game.
So why don't you run a game?
You know what? I don't have the time. I'm working real hard these days.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Well, thank you very much for the call. Good luck. If you're interested in, Andrew, you should drop us an email right now, and then that way anybody else in Watsonville is interested in doing some D&D with Andrew, you can as well, and we'll hook you guys up.
And
Saul. The phone number, the email address can be found at geekspeak.org. It's actually a form. Just send us a note. Thank you, Andrew, so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks.
So, D&D happens to be one of my passions. I do a little role-playing game. I am a geek in multiple levels, unfortunately. In high school and such, I was a theater geek, too. But now I mostly do computers, and so does Miles and Sean. We can handle pretty much any questions or comments about technology you'd like to ask us. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome and invited, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call with questions or comments about technology. Again, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
Oh, here's an interesting news story that I came across. This was by a group called VMware. They do virtual machines in software. And so you can run another operating system within an operating system. And one of the areas one of the directions this has run is the VMware server, which they release for free. Allows you to have one physical machine, but the equivalent of as many virtual machines as you'd like. So you can separate out the different capabilities, each box. And
does the each individual box actually run virtual of the system, or what does the individual box do? Just communicate with the primary server?
No, it can communicate. It depends on how you set up the networking, but they can look like a group of servers.
Mm-hmm.
It's because usually a server is not completely taxed; they go in and out. So by having multiple machines on a single multiple virtual machines on a single physical machine, you're ending up with an aggregate better performance.
Right. It's virtualization technology. And new processors support this in hardware now, too. They take a lot of that back end, weight off and do everything in hardware.
Right. But so if you'd like to give it a shot, VMware has released their VMware server product for free, and it's available at vmware.com.
Cool. Thank you very much, Miles. Let's go ahead and add that to the GeekSpeak site. I'm trying to do a little bit more of that using geekspeak.org to kind of make a running log of what we're doing on the show. From Santa Cruz, James, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, no problem. What's up?
Hey, great. I have a business. It's a shuttle company, and I'd like people to be able to do sort of an reservations online.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I work it now is they sort of send me an email with their flight details. And then I have to send them over to an online store, which is a GoDaddy product.
So that they can buy your product.
Mm-hmm. They're sort of independent of each other, and I'd like to know how I could make them with each other, I should say.
Yeah, so that someone can come to one site, reserve something, and then pay for it as well.
Right, and so all the information is being contained within one database, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Miles, you used to be a web developer. What do you think? How does someone that has a business find a solution for a problem of booking? I guess it's kind of like ticketing, certain time, reservation system and getting it paid for. How does that get built? How do you find it? How do you do that?
I plead ignorance.
Well, Miles, I know that you've actually built shopping cart systems in the past, so it can be a one person operation to some degree.
It can be. See, I don't want to consider myself an authority. I actually get fairly gun-shy with regard to,
because
to
of
online
that,
transactions.
Because the experience of doing that was very hard?
Well, no. the experience of doing it was difficult, but it was also to do with my own hesitation dealing with money. There's more at stake, I guess, is the thing.
So the whole infrastructure we have for geekspeak.org, you don't care because it's just all volunteer
stuff.
Well,
yeah, exactly.
We're not taking people's money or anything. We do it all for free.
Right, we don't have to worry about storing someone's credit card number. We don't have to worry about processing, making sure that communication is encrypted and the like. And there is software out there to make it possible.
Right.
But unfortunately, I haven't spent the time to recommend one.
See, Tom, this is definitely an issue. I mean, your system is a very specific type of application. Maybe someone has a reservation system for a small fleet shuttle service, but I doubt it. I'm assuming that the company that have it, they spent the time and resources to do it. We have a similar situation at KOSP where we run an auction every year. Well, actually, the pledge drives are a perfect example. You know, we twice a year we'll take a break and push that we, you know, provide great service to you, and it's free, but we'd love you to pay for it, kind of thing. You've heard it multiple times as an NPR and public radio listener, but the difficulty in it is that the generic shopping carts don't really work well with the idea of give us anything you'd like. They normally are buy this sock or buy these socks. So it's definitely difficult to fit into these shopping carts. I think that the thing you could do is spend a lot of money on a developer. And, you know, it's probably going to be, I don't know, $15,000-$20,000 to get a site to do what you want. Or deal with it the way you're dealing with it, unfortunately. I think one way to look at, you might want to look at PayPal, because if you're doing it through email right now, you could simply email them a PayPal bill. But then you're forcing everybody to have PayPal. So it's, I wouldn't say it's a simple solution. How about a credit card system in your shuttle so you pay on arrival? Does that work for you, Tom? I guess we lost Tom. Well, thank you so much for the call. It is difficult to get good web content, I would assume. We'll go ahead. No, we're going to have to say no more calls today. Miles and Sean, any one more news story?
Sure. I can do one.
Thanks.
So new research from Harvard Medical School, of all places, may increase the size of optical discs to 50 terabytes using proteins to store data, capturing light in a really interesting way.
Whoa, so,
and
so
setting
like
the molecules in intermediate states so that you have ones and, you know, like a one and zero
in
magnetic media. You can do the same thing with protein.
What would the medium be? I guess it would it spin?
Oh, yeah, it'd be just like what we have now.
But it would be molecular and therefore and probably
more stable.
You'd
probably use lasers to read the non-off states, you know, except that you can store 20 times more with the current, you know, state of the proteins.
Who's looking at this? Just a research right now, or is it a big company?
It's Professor Renugopalakrishnan of Harvard Medical
Sorry,
School.
Dude. Good said.
It's a salt marsh microbe called a Halobacterium slanarum. And right now, the intermediate stage only lasts a few hours, but they think they can probably get it to last a few years. If they can do that, then they've just got another, you know, way of storing data.
Lots of space.
Kind of cool.
This is Geek Speak, supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, answering the phone, Rick Philman, and all of you for calling in. Thank you for making Geek Speak what it is. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight by David Lawrence and is used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kosp.org. Oh, earlier in the show, we had Dean Takahashi on. You can learn more about his book on geekspeak.org. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned for Castle Cottage, just coming up in a few moments. But of course, first, the Slo County Report.